Well, good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in this our 16th season of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, Haiwang Wan, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Terry Perkins. Our speakers tonight are both graduates of the Environmental Science and Policy Doctoral Program at the University of South Florida in Tampa. Jason Polk is a native of Stevens City, Virginia, where his family has lived for decades in the northern Shenandoah Valley. His interest in caves and karst developed when he was exploring caves in the region when he was young. He expanded those interests to include climate change and water resources at the University of South Florida, receiving a PhD in 2009 for his research on climate change in karst environments, including field research in Belize and Florida. He joined the faculty of WKU in 2009 and is an associate professor of geosciences and director of the Center for Human Geo-Environmental Studies. He's conducted field work in the Caribbean, Iceland, Europe, China, and the U.S., authored dozens of research papers, and is a fellow of the National Speleological Society. At WKU, he teaches classes in global climate change, karst environments, geoscience methods, and geomorphology. When not teaching or researching, he enjoys caving, basketball, reading, traveling, photography, and spending time with his dogs and family. Leslie North is a native of Central Florida, where her family has lived for six generations. Her interest in environmental issues, particularly those related to karst environments and water resources, began as a very young child, since lakes, springs, rivers, national forests, and the ocean were her childhood playground. She earned bachelor's degrees in environmental science and anthropology and a master's degree in environmental science and policy from the University of South Florida. In 2011, she received a PhD in geography and environmental science and policy for her pioneering study of karst-related informal education programs in the U.S. and abroad. She joined the faculty of WKU in 2011. Her travel and research interests have taken her around the world. At WKU, she teaches environmental science, global sustainability, water resources, and environmental policy. She also serves as the program leader for the Department of Geography and Geology Environmental Program. And when not teaching or researching, she enjoys hiking, scrapbooking, traveling, swimming, and gardening. In the summer of 2015, Jason, Leslie, and Dr. Bernice Stranecki, who's here tonight, led a study abroad program to Iceland, where they participated in the Arctic Circle Roundtable. Here to tell us all about the land of fire and ice and extreme learning about climate change and many facets in Iceland, please welcome Leslie North and Jason Polk.
Thank you for that introduction, and I will try to roam too much, but it's really hard because I get pretty excited about this program in Iceland, and I'm really happy because I might as well go ahead and spoil the surprise. We have some honored guests here tonight, actually from the Arctic, which is obviously related to Iceland and where it's at geographically. We have guests here from Royal University in Newfoundland, right in the back, and then we also have our very own distinguished Icelander, all the way in the back, Embla, from the Iceland Arctic Cooperation Network. So we're very honored to have them here, and of course all of you, and to talk about this strange thing of learning in the land of fire and ice. So we thought about this way back when we were thinking about different places to study climate change, and what we basically came up with is a place that had all these: glaciers, volcanoes, waterfalls, coastal communities, ocean, renewable energy sources. Basically not Kentucky. Even though we have plenty to study here, we lack a couple of these things, if not most of these things. So we didn't want to just study the physical landscape features, we wanted to be able to study all the other aspects of this whole climate change topic, which includes everything from food and agriculture to economics to transportation, sustainability, health, you name it, it kind of falls under the umbrella, and we wanted to try to do as much as we could. So, this is Iceland. Some of you may recognize it, some of you may not. It's up there usually by the other big island, which is Greenland, which is much more noticeable on the map. And as you look at Iceland, I can give you some facts to put to the image, which is it's about 103,000 square kilometers, which is roughly the same size as Kentucky. And it has around 320,000 people, slightly outnumbered by the sheep. It's definitely outnumbered by the tourists that come each year, which you'll hear about three times over during the summertime. And so there's a bunch of other different facts on here that give you information about Iceland. And a lot of this you could easily get, but instead of just reading the book or in a classroom where we would typically come up and stand and lecture like this and give you these factoids, we figured it would be better if we actually just went ahead and traveled to Iceland. You can see we're kind of here at this yellow flag. It's not too far. It's around a 4-hour flight or so, give or take the tailwinds if you're heading there from Boston, New York, one of those places. So not hard to get to for us. So we decided to attack it. We donned our Viking gear, and to do it appropriately, the first time we did it by ship. So we thought we'd return the favor with the Vikings and go do some exploring. And it actually began our saga. If you know Iceland, you're familiar with the sagas. Started on the ship with the Semestric Sea Enrichment Voyage we did 2 years ago in the summer of 2014 with a group of around 60 faculty and students from Western Kentucky University and other places where we traveled there. Basically, as one stop of many stops in Northern Europe and Scandinavia. And our last stop actually was in Akureyri, which is in the north. We call it the gateway to the Arctic. And with that, we actually ended up presenting some of what we learned on this voyage to the students there and faculty. And we created a relationship, which has been blossoming ever since, between WKU and Iceland. And it's been really, really nice. And with the University of Akureyri there and Iceland Arctic Cooperation Network that I mentioned earlier, we now have lots and lots of programs related to research, student exchange, and of course, one of the big pieces is a course. I've been wanting to have another course. Just focused on Iceland, go there, keep the theme of the climate change challenge, and then see what happens when we bring a bunch of Kentuckians there for more than a day, and how they learn in this extreme environment and with another culture. So it's a co-taught course with Icelandic faculty and students, which makes it slightly more interactive and a little bit different than typical study abroads. So, to get there, we'll go back to the map. We started off in Reykjavik, the capital, as you can see here on the map. And then I'm going to take you through some of what we did down in the southern portion in Vík, and in the areas where we studied most of the physical landscape features. So I'm the physical science guy. I'll pass it over to Leslie, who can give you a lot more of the other aspects of how we interpret, understand, and communicate all of these physical landscape features and phenomena. So we started our visit with the Iceland Meteorological Office. We figured we'd go to the place where they study the glaciers, the volcanoes, and all the different processes that happen in Iceland. There's about 300 monitoring stations they have, and they basically monitor everything from the weather to the glacial melting to volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, you name it. It's all pretty much under their auspice. We're actually standing in front of this fancy radar gizmo that's attached to a big van, much more impressive than the 18 van. You can't quite see it, but you can live in it if you have to. And what this thing does is basically lets you scan the atmosphere and look at the dust and particulates. So if you remember back around 2010, there was a huge volcanic eruption. You might have had a flight that got interrupted by that. Well, this thing can help you scan and see the density of that and what's going on. And the airlines helped fund this, and it's several million dollars. So quite a gift, and they do lots of things with it when there's not volcanic eruptions. So we learned a lot about the Met Office and what they do. We have some really good colleagues there. We're doing some research and projects with them related to some different things with glaciers. So from there, we started to explore the things that everybody goes to see before they're gone, which are the glaciers. So we started with the Sólheimajökull Glacier. And if you can't say that, there's an Icelander in the back that can help you with the pronunciation. But don't ask me, because I only get it right once every 10 times, and that one worked. So to do this, the extreme learning started by getting to this glacier. It's not exactly easy to get to a glacier if you've ever been to one. So we had to go and do some hiking, some crawling, and it started out where there was no glacier. We see just rock, lots of volcanic rock and no glacier. Eventually, we got to the glacier, but it was just the end, the tongue of the glacier, they call it, just the very terminus of it. So you can't really get onto the glacier and do much here, but you do start to see a lot of things, characteristics, features. things our students start to understand more about how the glacier melts, how it moves, that it's actually alive in a way. A lot of the black that you see is all of that volcanic rock and debris that's been tilled up and pushed out in front of the glacier like a bulldozer. And that also has some implications because as you see more and more of the glacier, you see more and more of this black coating, which is fairly natural, but at the same time also has implications because it absorbs heat and helps the glacier melt a little faster, which can be a bad thing if it melts too fast. So this glacier was not just a random glacier. It was actually really important because it was featured in a documentary that came out a couple years ago called Chasing Ice. And if you've ever seen that, it's really, really good because it's basically all about tracking the movement of glaciers using photography and video. And so this particular glacier was actually documented, and in the last 10 years, it retreated roughly a mile each year. Think about it, 1 mile each year for the last 10. 100 years prior to the last 10, it retreated 1 mile total. So 1 mile in 100 years, and then 1 mile every year for the last decade. So pretty impressive, pretty important, and this has been documented, so we know that this is scientifically factual. And then there's a bunch of other glaciers on Iceland that make up roughly about 9% of it. Used to be around 11, but it's decreasing as the glaciers melt and decrease in size. So the Chasing Ice documentary is really nice. We got a bunch of our students who were on the trip here this year. They actually got to meet the person who did the documentary when we were at a conference a few months ago, and he was doing a book signing, so that was really nice. And he was happy we were visiting his glacier. So from there, we went to two other glaciers. Now, Vatnajökull is the largest glacier in Iceland and the second largest in Europe. So small glaciers melting pretty fast, we get it. What about bigger ones? What about this thing at the bottom, which is slightly different? It's not an actual glacier by itself. It's a glacier with a lagoon in front of it. So the students starting to develop some understanding about how this all works. Another long trek. In this case, we wanted to get on the glacier. Not just to come see the glacier, but let's get on it, see how it works. So we went to the glacier and hiked on the glacier. And we hiked through it, around it, started to understand the mechanisms of how glaciers work, how climate affects them, how they melt. We got inside parts of the glacier to understand more about where the water, as it melts away, the water has to go somewhere. Well, it goes down into the glacier, underneath the glacier, off the glacier, goes in lots of places. So that's what we started to study. And then once we realized the water had to go somewhere, we went to this glacial lagoon, the Jökulsárlón. So we went on these land boats. You might have seen these in other places in the world. And basically, piled all the students on and went to take a ride on what is the deepest area here. It's the deepest lagoon of its nature in Iceland. And so we wanted to see how it was created. And it's only about 1,000 years old. So it's not really that old. Most of the glaciers in Iceland are only about 1,000 years old. You hear about glaciers other places, and they're usually a lot older in a lot of ways. So this lake is roughly 300 feet deep. And you can actually see several glaciers that feed these pieces of ice breaking off, floating away, and then the lagoon is right next to the ocean. You can't miss it. So it's not very big. It's about 18 square kilometers, this lake. So pretty easy to see from the glacier to the ocean the process of how the ice melts and then makes its way. So you're actually seeing there the glacier itself with all these ripples and the ice as it meets the lagoon and goes away. So starting to put the picture together, connect the dots. We have the ice, we have the melting, we have the water. What happens to all the water that's not in the lagoon and goes other places that we don't see? And then to do that, the obvious thing was what Iceland's really famous for, which is waterfalls. Lots and lots of huge, amazing, impressive waterfalls. And so we started to study how the water moves. And here are three of the more impressive waterfalls we visited more than this. So Skógafoss is one of the first, and this is actually draining a large part of some of the glaciers I just described. And it creates some pretty impressive waterfalls. This is another one that you'll see. This is a waterfall that's Godafoss, the waterfall of the gods. You might have seen it featured in a movie or two. It's been used for lots and lots of different cinema, and a lot of different stories go along with this back in all the old ancient lore. My favorite, though, was this one. This is Deadafoss. This is the largest waterfall in Iceland, and the debate's a lot a little bit here and there depending on who you ask, but also the largest in Northern Europe and Scandinavia. And so it's roughly 150 feet tall. It's a little over 300 feet wide. It's certainly impressive. Not every waterfall comes with its own glacier. It's melting off into it, which is what this actually is, and then it's a rainbow. which we thought was just for us, arranged by Icelanders. But it turns out it's there often. And obviously it's an aspect of the waterfall. And it's a pretty impressive place, and certainly you can start to understand how much water is moving off these glaciers as they melt, and that it's going someplace, often into these rivers, carving out the landscape. And certainly it has its positive benefits too. So it's not always a negative thing to have glacier melt. Unless they'll talk more about that. So after we talked about some of these different aspects and the students got their legs worn out hiking on glaciers and climbing over waterfalls and understanding that part, the other aspect was volcanoes. A lot of these glaciers have volcanoes underneath of them. So that enhances some of the melting, so that the last thing we need is anything that add to the melting. But occasionally the glaciers do have these massive floods that happen called Jökulhlaups. There are these massive floods that when a volcano starts to erupt underneath the glacier, obviously the ice melts even more quickly and you can have these massive floods. So we wanted to study something about those processes and how they influenced the glacial processes. So several different areas to do that. You might have heard of this Eyjafjallajökull volcano. This is the one that erupted in 2010 that caused all the air traffic concerns and issues. Massive eruption. Not a lot of issues as far as hazards to the folks that live in Iceland, but certainly a lot of disruptions all across that area of the world related to travel. So we got a little bit deeper into it. We wanted to study some of the rocks. We wanted to study a little bit about how these processes inside the earth were happening in a place and why is it so active? Why are there so many different volcanic hotspots and so many eruptions? So we started to understand a little bit more about how that worked and also how it influences the water. A little bit about how it influences the water. It's moving because a lot of that water also goes into the ground. Is in the rocks, not just in the waterfalls and the rivers. And so we started connecting it back to things like geysers. So this is the oldest geyser in Iceland, discovered back around 1294, and our students are running from it. So we got up close and personal, but not too close and personal. This is not so bad. They had an earthquake a few years back, and because of the changes in the way the water flows from that earthquake, this can actually go up to 400 feet in here. So it can be quite impressive and a whole lot more intense than this little eruption that we had here. And so the geyser is actually another function of the geothermal activity, the volcanoes, the water coming from the glaciers going into the ground. So lots of connections were made, including knowing not to get too close to the geyser when it erupted. And then the last stop, we tried to really bring it all together by visiting a rare place you get to see, and that is where two tectonic plates come together. So we visited these two tectonic plates where the North American Eurasian plates come together, and it's actively still separating and changing at about 2 centimeters per year. Iceland's actually growing. It's actually getting bigger by about 5 centimeters per year because of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and the fact that land mass is being created from the various eruptions and changes. And it's also affected by when the glaciers melt. All that weight is taken off. Iceland's actually coming up out of the sea and rising. So some interesting things, because as we talked about climate change, we related it back to sea levels rising, and we asked the Icelanders, they said, well, so is Iceland. It's okay. It's no problem. We're not worried about it. As long as we rise faster than it does, we'll be fine. And the other nice thing is that, of course, all this volcanic rock lends to really nice black volcanic sand beaches, which are not normal. A lot of people from Kentucky, particularly our students, have not seen any beaches. And then they see these, then they hopefully don't think that all beaches are black with sand. So kind of unique and different, not something you see around here in the U.S. very often, unless it's from an oil spill or something we don't want. So right now we've sort of taken the journey with the students and understood a little bit about what they've done, what they've seen, how they've started to put together all these physical landscape processes and learned about some of the glacier volcanic dynamics related to climate change. But we really wanted to drive it home, because these are all things that are happening now, all things that are fairly modern, things that you can go and see. So how do they really put that into a context of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years? So we decided we would get deeper into it and visit something that opened literally just days before we arrived last year, and that is an ice cave. So we started by talking about ice cores. This is J.P. Stephenson. He actually is one of the most well-known ice core scientists. And these ice cores serve as proxies for various types of climate data. So if you want to understand temperature changes, changes in carbon dioxide, or anything related to climatic past, you can go back thousands to hundreds of thousands, even longer years, and start to understand more about what's going on. So we wanted to go get our own. His was nice, but we wanted to go and see more about what's going on in Iceland. So we had to do off-road busing, which is kind of different if you've not done it before. Because it's not often that when you're on a bus heading down the highway, you make a left-hand turn and the driver gets real excited. Why are you so excited? He just drives the bus all day. And you realize when you look out the window, it's because you have this. Most buses don't go on these types of roads very often. If you're in the US and it turns left and goes on this road, you probably won't be very happy. Probably a little nervous actually about where you're gonna end up. So we were a little nervous. We ended up at this. We stopped in the middle of nowhere and we met this vehicle, which looks slightly more impressive. This is an old NATO missile launcher brought in from Germany. There's three of them, I believe, brought in by this company and this whole experience, which is the ice cave. And they've been heavily modified in order to be able to actually go up on top of the ice cap. So beyond the glacier, what feeds the glacier is an ice cap, the bigger, larger white areas you see on the map that are these massive ice caps. And so this thing has 48 gears, so it can just crawl along and go on strange terrains, different angles. All of the tires can be controlled automatically to inflate and deflate to give it better traction from the cab of it. And the scariest part is that we got in this thing, and it was not so bad here, really windy, a little bit crazy. As we started to go up the ice cap, I could not tell you what it looked like because we never saw anything. All we saw outside the window was just snow and wind and ice. It was just like a whiteout. So I don't know which direction we went, but the guy kept telling us. He kept telling us, it's okay. I can't see where I'm going, but I have GPS navigation. Oh, the GPS. Nope, the GPS is back. We're good. We thought he was kidding, but then we could hear in there when they would sometimes leave the mic on him talking back to his friend. They didn't actually know where they were going at first. And he wasn't just messing with us. He was serious. So eventually we did get there. It took a little longer than what we thought. We had to do a little bit of turning around. But we got to this thing. Pretty impressive. So an artificially created cave at the top of this ice cap. You can see here some of the lighting and whatnot. It looks like a tunnel, but it's actually dug into the ice. And you can see here a little bit better what it looks like, which is just these white layers of ice. And you can begin to kind of discern and see some of the layering in there. If you zoom in a little bit closer, all of these lines that you see represent layers. And each one of these layers of ice records the climate and what was going on when it was deposited. So as snow falls, if you have more snow fall than snow melt, you end up with this accumulated ice. And it just keeps building up over hundreds of years. And this one's been about 1,000 years old. So each one of those layers represents around a year or so. And if there's a volcanic eruption, it lays down a whole bunch of ash, probably a dark layer. If it's a really, really snowy year, there's lots and lots of snow, probably one of these thicker layers in between. So once you get up into the glacier itself, into this ice cap, and you start to see this, students then began putting it together. They could see all the things they were observing as they went from the glaciers to the lagoon to the river to the volcanic areas. All of that was being recorded here. So they could start to understand how the history of all of these different climatic activities and Iceland itself, the whole physical landscape, changed year after year for hundreds of years, and obviously for even beyond that. And so we felt pretty good. They learned, they understood some of the physical science aspects, but then they kept saying, what are we supposed to do with it? I said, well, let's get out of here and go find out. Fortunately, the problem is to get out, we had to go through that blizzard that had somehow changed, as weather often does on top of an ice cap. So these are our students trying to escape. There's no entrance, there's no door, there's no heated area. It's just a hole in an ice cap that you go down inside of. Again, it's only been open a few days. They said they were working on getting a guy up there who was going to keep it shoveled open. So we hope you have a guy who's keeping it shoveled open when we get to the exit. And they didn't. So we had to shovel it open ourselves. And then this is what it was like, to give you the first-hand experience. Again, remember, dozens of students from Kentucky. No glacier, no ice cap, no anything. At this point, everybody was okay. It didn't seem so bad. It just seemed cold, kind of like we've had the last week or so here in Bowling Green. And then all of a sudden things changed. At this point, we weren't having much fun. We had one person fall down. We thought we lost them forever. But we saved them. That guy right there that you saw, braving the elements, he's from Alaska. He was on the trip with us. I'm just holding my hand out. Makes our weather here look not so bad last week. This was in June. Summertime. So we survived. The very end is my favorite part though. This guy you're seeing here, who looks like a snowsicle, his name is Captain Rick Fest, and he is actually one of the captains off Deadliest Catch. Watch that show from Alaska to Bering Sea. He's one of the crab boat captains who was with us talking about different things related to ocean processes, fisheries, that sort of thing. So he was a nice addition for the students who didn't expect to have celebrity on there, but turns out he's a really down-to-earth guy. I know a lot about ocean processes and climate change. He's been looking at for 20 years about all sorts of different things, from currents to CO2 and whatnot. So all in all, we learned a lot about all these physical landscape activities. We survived going in the ice cave and coming out, but now we had to figure out what to do next. So I want to hand that over to Leslie, and she's going to tell you a little bit about once you zoom into Iceland and start to understand more about how all these landscapes interact, what happens.
Well, thank you. So the first thing that we're going to start off with is talking about geothermal energy and how we kind of thought we would approach the second half of this is really telling you some of the stories of things that happened more or a little bit less so than telling you about some of the things that we've learned. So geothermal energy, if you've never been to Iceland, it's obviously very big there because of all the volcanic activity that Jason was just mentioning. You can actually walk around. You can walk around, and some spots on the landscape are just warmer. You can actually feel on your feet a warmer area from all the geothermal activity. The steam that you see coming out, that's actually geothermal vents. So it's so hot underground that once it hits the cool surface air, you end up with all of these steam everywhere. So what Iceland has done is they're creating geothermal energy. Actually, about 80% of the electricity comes from hydropower, but they're trying to improve that. They use geothermal energy for a lot of water heating. So, or not water heating, but for in the homes rather than temperature for general electricity. So what you're seeing here, these pipes, as they're going along, this is piping in hot water. And whereas here, where we actually have to heat our water before we're using it, in Iceland the objective is to cool the water before you use it because it's so hot. So they're piping the water above the land surface so that it can actually cool down and not literally scald them when they turn on their tap. So hot water heaters are not a thing that necessarily exists in most of Iceland. Another thing that they're doing with the geothermal energy is they're actually creating geothermal greenhouses, which is kind of a neat concept when you think about it. And you might be asking yourself, what are they growing in the greenhouses? And oddly enough, it's bananas. So Iceland is trying to come up with a program where they can have these banana greenhouses, essentially. This coming summer when we go, we're also going to visit a tomato greenhouse. So they're experimenting with different fruits and vegetables to try to figure out what they can grow best in these particular geothermal greenhouses. And our students, you know, of course, we take a group of students and they see bananas growing in a greenhouse. The first question is, can we please have a banana? So yes, they got to take their bananas on the boat or on the bus ride. There was all these little baby bananas everywhere because they all decided that they had to have one. Apparently the consensus is they taste the same, just like a banana. So the geothermal energy can be a great thing. It can provide lots of opportunities. You can grow bananas in Iceland. It can also prevent or cause some challenges. So this is actually a tunnel that they're building in the north in Akureyri, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But this tunnel, the idea was that it's 7.5 kilometers, and they wanted to go through a mountain to connect Akureyri to some of the other towns on the other side of the mountain. We were told that this came about because there were literally women who were trying to get to a hospital and they were having children in the middle of the car because they couldn't get around the mountain or other people who were ill couldn't get to a hospital. So the idea was, let's build a tunnel through the mountain and solve the problems. Sounded great. Problem was, as they're building this tunnel, they actually hit a geothermal vent, basically a pool of hot water. So this is boiling hot water that has been boiling out of the side of this tunnel since April 2013. And it's just pouring out the side of this tunnel. The idea is that there's nothing really they know what to do with it. They don't really have a plan. The idea that they told us was, well, eventually it'll run out. The problem is that was 2013, and we can assure you, because we were in the tunnel, it has not run out. It still is rolling pretty good. The fjord, from an environmental point of view, this is an icy cold fjord, and this hot water is pouring into it, so it's actually changing some of the ecosystem and the temperatures in the fjord. So they're also starting to kind of realize maybe just letting it run out isn't going to be the best idea, but they don't know what to do with it. So, interesting challenges. Another thing that we did is we actually visited some turf houses. So turf houses were an original kind of settlement in Iceland. The use of them stopped, but in several of the more rural places, they're starting to try to experiment with them again. In other parts of Europe, they're also starting to see people come over and actually examine what do you do and how do you construct a turf house. So they're starting to pop up and they're being kind of like a sustainable model. They're pretty neat. So as you can see here, they basically take this thick turf and they build it up and it looks just like a house. The students got to go into it. You toured around. One thing that we found fascinating as you're walking along the countryside and, oh, there's a window. Oh, there's a house under there. So it was kind of a neat experience. We actually saw them at this one place, but they're scattered all over parts of Iceland. So I think one of my favorite things that we did was went to Siglufjord. So Akureyri is here, and then Siglufjord is up here. This is actually a big herring town, or at one point was a huge herring town, and they created a museum about the herring industry that used to be there. So this is an actual full-size replica of a herring ship. It's inside of this museum to give you any indication of the scale. So the students can walk on the ship and experience it. But I say it's one of my favorites because I study museums and how people learn through these types of environments. And I can tell you, this is probably the most eerie museum I have ever stepped foot in. And I say that in a good way, surprisingly. Because how they built the museum is it looks like people were there one day, they went home from work, and they never came back. They have it designed that way because that's essentially what happened. It was a huge herring village, and one day the fish were just being overfished, the changes were happening in the ocean currents, and the fish were gone. So the entire industry essentially shut down and they left. So there's a mechanic shop. It's part of this museum and there's tools and bolts and all kinds of stuff laying around on the ground because it looks as though someone was mechanicking, they took a break and just never came back. So it's really eerie, but it really kind of drives home this message of how quickly things can change in this really kind of extreme location. So Grimsay. Similar to the ice cave experience, Grimsay was kind of like a rite of passage for our students and probably like a badge of honor. So we decide in our infinite brilliant moment, we're going to go from Akureyri, we're going to take a bus to Siglufjord, and then we're going to catch a ferry and we're going to go to Grimsay. Sounds wonderful. What we didn't really realize is the day before is when we went to Siglufjord to the Herring Museum. And as Jason mentioned earlier, we had faculty from Iceland co-teaching the course with us. And as we're walking around Siglufjord and we're walking around the docks and seeing the avalanche walls and doing all this stuff, the professor who was with us kept giggling. Like he would just look out of the ocean and start giggling. Or he would say, oh, you're taking a ferry ride tomorrow. And kind of giggle. And we're like, oh, that's cute. You know, what's the deal? This particular professor was an oceanographer. So he spends about 6 months of his life out on the ocean, studying the ocean currents around the North Atlantic region. Okay, he's giggling. And we're kind of starting to sense something's not quite kosher here. So let's do it anyways. We're going to go to Grimsay. We're going to go to this little island. And the reason why we're going there is because we also had medical professionals with us. So we were going to study rural health and some of the challenges that you have when you have this isolated population on this island. It's also owned by Iceland. Here we are, about to board the ferry, all is well. Leaving port, still going well. The students are feeling strong. And then, the wonderful ocean fought back. This is our students running for the hill. We did a lot of running. Can you get everyone? Like running from geysers or running from ice caves. As a person who gets motion sickness, I can tell you for 3 hours we figurated across the ocean to Grimsay. There were four people among our group who were not motion sick, Jason being among a few strong ones. Jason and Captain Rick, who spends his life in the Bering Sea, and Steingerman, the oceanographer. They were three of the strong who survived. The rest of us were not in such hot shape. I can show you some pictures of what happened at the end of the thing, but it was quite eventful. I don't know if it was more eventful for the Kentuckians who were now on the ocean or for the ferry boat operators who were trying to figure out why there were 30 Kentuckians on this boat causing havoc everywhere. It was quite eventful for everyone involved. So one of the reasons, in addition to studying rural health, that we went there is this is actually a place where you can cross the Arctic Circle. So it did have a mission, and the students were like, that's cool, we get to cross the Arctic Circle. The other thing that we got to do there is see the puffins, which I've been to Iceland many times, and every time they say, oh, there's puffins. I never saw a puffin, so I was really starting to doubt the fact that they had puffins in Iceland until we went to Grimsay. They do have puffins. I've seen them. But what they don't tell you is the puffins live in these holes, and it looks like this thick mat. So it's really kind of like a hazard zone as you're walking along, and then, whoop, you fall into this puffin hole, essentially. So the puffins are definitely fighting back from the hunting that's going on. So this is our students on our way back. We had quite the challenge convincing the students that you were now on Grimsay, but yes, we had to go back to the mainland. We actually had a couple students go to the airport and ask them if there was a flight out, and they said the flight's one day a week, and it's not today. So sorry for your bad luck. So what they decided to do in their infinite student wisdom is they were going to take just about every single sleeping pill and Dramamine that they could get their hands on. So this is the scene of our students on the way back. The mission was run in the boat as fast as you can, take everything you can, and try to fall asleep. And if you can sleep through it, it'll be good. So that's what they did. Most of them were successful. Still, some of them were figurating across the ocean. So as though that wasn't bad enough, the next day, actually, we decided that we were going to take them on another boat. That was fun. So we, too, now have to convince them, it's okay, we're not leaving before this time. We're just going to stay. We're not going on the open ocean. Won't be as bad. Half of them spent that time sleeping because they took everything they could get their hands on. The other half, we actually went out on this boat to whale watch as well as fish. So the idea was that we were going to catch our dinner. I can assure you, as Kentuckians, ocean fishing, not our strong suit. This was the only fish that was caught. And actually, it was caught by the single high schooler from Florida that we had on the voyage with us, so I'm quite proud of my Florida friend there. He held strong for my state. Luckily, the operators of the boat kind of put two and two together what we might not be so hot at the ocean fishing, and so they brought food on board for us and already had it. We're like, it's okay, we figured this would happen, we have food for you. But we did go fishing, it was quite fun. Another thing, a beautiful area that we went to is the Lake Neva area. And so we go to Lake Neva. This is one of the preserved wetlands of the world because of its bird population that it has there. So we were looking at some of the ecosystems. We were also looking at the surface streams. This is our students testing out the water quality of the surface streams. They also went underground. This is actually geothermal, basically a hot spring underground. So we got to do some of that. It was quite fun. And everything was going well until this guy showed up to the party. This is a midge. Does anybody know what a midge is? A couple of you know midges. Oh, midges. So the best way I can describe a midge is it's a mosquito that doesn't bite. That's essentially what it is. So this guy's fine, but the problem is that this guy has 10 million friends. And so here they are, if you can see them, flying around. And so, in what Kentucky does when they're extreme learning in Iceland, we ran. So you can see them swarming, all of the students, their clothes. I think her face sums it up the best. The midges. The midges were quite a bit of fun. But what we were able to learn through this running experience was that actually they're the start of the entire ecosystem of Lake Neva. So the midges population, they can determine how the ecosystem is going to be that year based upon if it's a good year, mid-year, or if it's a bad mid-year. So we asked, is this a good mid-year or a bad mid-year? And we're like, well, we haven't really decided yet. And we're thinking, if this was a bad one, I would hate to see a good one. But they are quite important for that area, and I guess the people who live there just learn to live with the midges. The good news is they don't bite. Next thing, we decided, of course, to try the Icelandic cuisine. What you may not know is Iceland's actually world famous for their hot dogs, of all things. They are different hot dogs than us, and particularly that a lot of them are lamb hot dogs. And also the toppings that are on them are quite unique. So they have like two kinds of mustards and kind of a ketchup, but it's not like our traditional yellow mustard. They're almost kind of sweet. So our students tried that. They also tried the infamous puffins. This is why I say they don't exist in Iceland, because you can eat them in Iceland. I did not try the puffins because I've just spent, you know, 8 trips to Iceland trying to find one. There was no way I was going to eat one. But the students who did say that they were delicious, they did try the puffins. Another kind of unique experience that we tried to offer the students is we took even the dining experiences and we tried to make them educational and fun. So in this particular location, we are eating a volcano soup. So this place was a farm at one point in time, and as a volcano went off, the farm got covered with all of the ash. And the people from the community came in and helped the farm basically literally shovel themselves out of all of the ash. And so as a thank you to the workers who kept showing up every day to help them, they started making the soup to provide them for lunch. And it eventually became known as the volcano soup. So we went there, we talked to them, we learned about what happens when you have a farm that now is no longer a farm, and it's actually turned into a restaurant because of the volcanic activity that they were having to deal with. This is a woman, and she is making breads, actually delicious breads, I might add, on geothermal ovens. So these are ovens, they're outside, it's just geothermal steam coming out of the ground, and they use it as an oven. So again, having the dining experience be part of the learning and the educational material and how this all works. So wrapping up, one of the things that was mentioned in the introduction is our students also got a really unique opportunity to participate in the Arctic Circle Roundtable. And this was a ceremony from where the Canadians were passing over the chairmanship of the Arctic Circle to the United States. So it just so happened that we knew the ambassadors to Iceland from Canada and from the U.S. They like us. So they invited us to this roundtable, and our students got to participate in this very important symbolic representation. And this is the ambassador from the U.S. to Iceland, and they also joined us for dinner. Our students got to pick their brains on, if you want to go work in the State Department, what is that like? How do you do that? So it was a really kind of unique opportunity for our students. The last couple of things, one of the things that we always do is incorporate service learning, because we don't want to have a group of students just kind of plop somewhere, study, use some resources, and plop out. So we try to give back, we try to learn through doing service. And one of the models that we're using is the $100 Solution, which Bernie Strunecki, who's in the audience, is actually the founder of the $100 Solution. So when we were there originally on the Toppers at Sea voyage that Jason mentioned in the beginning, we planted an apple tree as one of the $100 solutions. And we planted an apple tree because symbolically, apples have never been able to grow in Iceland. But their climate is changing so much that now they can have apples growing. So we planted this tree, and what we did is we went back. And the idea was that every year we'll be able to go to this tree, and it's almost like a living science laboratory that we can see, is it healthy? Is it still able to grow in this place that before apples had never been able to grow, but now they can? There are apples, I can assure you, so it is growing, it is healthy, but this is just one of the many projects that we're trying to do to always give back to the communities and learn through that process. So I can tell you, in the land of the midnight sun, and we say that because we did get an opportunity to ride the Icelandic horses, which are their own presentation all over themselves. But this picture was taken at about 11 o'clock at night, so hence why it's the land of the midnight sun. So we did that, and our students were able to learn all kinds of things. And it meant something different to every one of them. So one of the toppers at sea students, Katie Adams, here at the bottom, we had the opportunity, myself, Jason, Bernie Strunecki, and some others, had the opportunity to meet the president of Iceland. And as you go to meet a president of a country, you have to bring some kind of gift. So we said, okay, we have to bring a gift, and it cannot be a paperweight. Like, this has to be something pretty significant. So Katie was one of the artists on the voyage with us, and I commissioned her and I said, Katie, you know, we have to meet the president of the country. Can you produce something that kind of symbolizes the relationship between the U.S. and WKU, the Iceland and the University of Akureyri, and the Iceland Arctic Cooperation Network, and climate change, and all the things that you learned? So she did, and she produced this horse, so a symbolic of the Icelandic horse. But if you flip it around, the Icelandic horse is actually meeting a Kentucky thoroughbred at the edge of the waterline, symbolizing the glaciers that are melting at that time. So yeah, so you have the Icelandic horse, because obviously Iceland is very well known for our horses. In Kentucky, what better to symbolize Kentucky than our Kentucky thoroughbreds? So that's how she symbolized the relationship between the two places and what it had meant to her. And with that, I will invite you to visit the Hilltoppers in Iceland WordPress blog. The idea is that the students every year will continue to add to this, and they have pictures and all kinds of fun stuff that we couldn't begin to tell you here tonight for the sake of time. And we will, of course, invite any questions, and thank you for your time and attention.
We have time for questions.
Angela, do you want to say anything in Icelandic? That's what my students asked her. She came and taught in one of my classes, and she goes in this whole lecture, and the first question, or one of the questions is, can you just say something in Icelandic? So, you want to say something in Icelandic?
What do you want to say?
Anything!
Embla Oddsdóttir og frá Íslandi. Ég búin að vera hérna í Kentucky í heila viku núna og að velta því fyrir mig hvort að ég flyt ekki bara hingað. Við höfðum mjög gaman af því að hlusta á, að hafa fá nemendur frá Kentucky og fleiri stöðum í heimsókn til ykkar. Basically that was. My name is Embla, I'm from Iceland. I've been here in Kentucky for a week and I'm thinking I'm settling down. You have really good food. And it was great fun to have the students in Iceland.
Is that every Icelander we've ever met speaks English. That's the great news, because we basically know about three words, maybe. And even then they have to kind of coach us along how to say it multiple times before we pick it up.
So. I know we have some potential tourists to Iceland. What are the logistics of getting there? Is it expensive?
Iceland is surprisingly very easy to get to and to navigate around. I think people hear Iceland and they think, oh my gosh, it's this exotic frozen tundra where there's nobody and they're, they just couldn't possibly speak English and I'm just going to wander around lost. Actually, we found it very easy, very welcoming. The cost of the tickets fluctuate quite a bit depending on what season you want to go in. As Jason said, they have over a million tourists and they all come from about June to August, early September. So if you want to find lodging, you have to book it literally a year in advance. That's actually our biggest challenge that we have. They just don't have the facilities. They're outgrowing their capacity. But if you go in, say, May, early May, the weather actually isn't that bad. We joke at some of the things, but on the other glaciers, I was walking around in a short sleeve sweater. So it's actually pretty nice during that time, or it can be from what Embla tells us. It can also be quite drastically different. But yeah, it's pretty easy. The people, as I said, everyone speaks English. Everywhere you go, restaurants, you can always find stuff in English. So it's very welcoming and very friendly culture. Everyone's extremely friendly.
Over here, yes.
You said the glaciers are actually, Dr. Polk said the glaciers were about 1,000 years old. What happened 1,000 years ago to make glaciers?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's a complex.
Was there a climate change at that time, or what?
There was some climatic change that happened back a couple different cycles we've gone through in the last 1,000, 1,200 or so years. We had something called the medieval climate anomaly. It happened back then. It was for a couple hundred years that actually was a warming, not everywhere. And we had something called the little ice age that happened about 350 or so years ago. It was like a little miniature ice age. Neither one of those really has much impact on how these glaciers form. Mostly it's a function of how big a glacier can get before it reaches a threshold. So because of the elevation, the topography, and the way that the glaciers form, they basically accumulate to a certain degree, and then they start to sort of melt away. You know, all the glaciers, when you see these things, they're not like your ice caps like you see in Greenland or other places where these massive thick ice caps continue to build. The ice caps are kind of small. And they're up on these mountains that are not very big, and so once they reach capacity, they're basically full of ice, the glaciers begin. The glaciers are basically, think of it as a flowing river of ice. So when the bathtub is full, the water comes out. When the ice cap is big enough, the glaciers flow away, and that on average takes about 1,000 years. So, and some people have speculated different things. Maybe it's related to climate cycles, maybe it's related to the 1,000-year turnover of ocean circulations, maybe it's related to the Gulf Stream. There's a lot of different reasons for it, but really now it's something we're studying more because they're melting away and that's changing. They're not going to be 1,000 years old anymore, and they may not be there at all. They anticipate that probably by the year 2100, at least two of the glaciers in Iceland will be gone. Be completely gone. So you've got to think about these things. They're hundreds of square miles in size and thickness, you know, of tens or hundreds of feet. So a substantial loss in just a short amount of time. So Emily, do you have something you want to add back there? Seal of approval. We're really glad this was well received, and it really is a nice place to go. Don't let us, only if you come with us, then it's extreme learning, because you can do the just regular kind. It's nice, great food, really casual, no problem at all. Everyone knows all the good spots. So,
the President and Julie stayed the whole time, or
they were on the ship.
Yeah, on the ship only.
Oh,
so we were there for one day.
Ice cave or anything like that?
No, but they should.
Just like to add. Yes, in spring, not in summer.
It's the one thing you didn't see in our presentation. You might have put two and two together with the Land of the Midnight Sun fact is the Northern Lights, which are typically an everyday thing, but not during the summer. So another advantage to going sort of the off season, even though the weather might not be as nice. We were there in October. It was phenomenal. It was great. It was better than the weather is here right now. And you can see the Northern Lights and the whole deal. So, yeah, it's changing a lot. And it continues to change. Who knows?
I was just going to say that Iceland kind of has a saying very similar to our hearts. And that is, if you don't like the weather today or in this moment, hang around for 5 or 10 minutes, maybe a day, and it'll be completely different. You'll feel home, because that's Iceland. It is beautiful some days, and then you might have a rough day here and there. But overall, it's a wonderful.
I thought this was interesting, the special relationship that exists between WKU and Iceland. Very, very special. One of the unique ones in the world. And my two friends from Canada will make the next partnership, and that will become work in Canada, Iceland, as well as WKU. This is spectacular and very, very unique in the world, and I'm so proud of my
couldn't do it without Bernie. He certainly played a major role in putting all this together, visiting there, making the context, generating the relationship, nurturing all of this, leading the course, pioneering the $100 solution. So much thanks to Bernie for making all this possible and continuing to make it possible. But we got to find some warm places to go to. So next time we'll talk about some place in the Caribbean, and even my Arctic friends will agree.
One more question?
Yes.
On that note, we'll turn, being a Canadian, it's exciting to have these Canadians here tonight too. We'll turn now to our door prize, and we have a copy of, just to encourage tourism, a copy of Lonely Planet's Guide to Iceland. And I know you'll want to join with us in thanking our speaker, Jason and Leslie, for a very interesting talk, and I'm sure you'll like to chat with them after. And on behalf of them, thank you very much for being a guest. And we want to thank all of you for coming out on a chilly night. We'll be back next month on March 31st when Diane King will be here to talk about her recent travels and new book on Kurdistan. So we hope you'll join us. And have a good evening.
Thank you all.